Oh, I am so excited about today. Joshua is one of my very favorite stories in the whole Old Testament, and we get to spend the entire day looking at the records of the battles, and it's going to be really, really fun. I called this seminar Joshua, God's Strategies for Victory. And so I found a really wonderful definition of the word strategy. It's simply a plan of action designed to achieve a particular goal. So let me say it again. A plan of action designed to achieve a particular goal. So when we are going through and we're going to be looking at these five major battles that are described in Joshua's chapter 6 through 11, and God has a purpose for everything he puts in the Word. So one of the things that we're going to see today is why these five major battles or campaigns are in Joshua. Because there were a lot of other battles that they fought, but these are the ones that God wanted us to know about, and we can learn some really great things from them. Now, a strategy is something that you can use in business or sometimes, there's a strategy in politics, or how about in sports? You know, a team would have a strategy of how they're going to win the game, right? Well, in warfare, a strategy has to do with like a key or a method. You could say method. Like, this is the method that was going to win this battle. This is the method that's going to win this battle. But it's a plan of action. And within that plan of action, then, we are going to see keys. So you see your outline that you have in front of you here. And this is basically a summary of everything I'm going to share today. So you can have it for your enjoyment and to follow along. And then there's you can see on the right-hand side there's New Testament references, and some of those we're going to be reading, but some of them also you can just look up later. And what Joshua, the whole book of Joshua, is about is really a comparison that we can compare it to the experience and battles in life that we have as born-again Christians. Now, I know it's the Old Testament, right? But the kind of description of the warfare, what happened, how they went in to claim the promised land, that's basically the whole theme of the book of Joshua. And the things that I want us to see today are the application to us. Because it's wonderful to just read the book and get all excited, oh yeah, they won and all that, but what I really want us to see today is that these are the same lessons that we need to learn so we could walk into the promised land spiritually of our lives. And basically there's four types of Christians. And everyone who's born again of God's Spirit is blessed with all spiritual blessings, right? That's what Ephesians 1:3 says. Well, there are different responses that a Christian can have. And some, here's the four. Some people want to stay in the world or stay in Egypt. The second group of people wander around in the wilderness and they mutter and complain and mumble and grumble and talk about how awful everything is and why isn't this happening and why isn't that happening. I call them the murmurers. And so that's the second group. The third group are those who, when the children of Israel started to come into the promised land, they came on the east side of the Jordan. And 2.5 of the tribes, of the 12 tribes, decided they wanted to stay on that side. They liked the land. They had a bunch of cattle. They saw this beautiful hills there. And they said, oh, well, we'll just stay over here. And so I call those guys the Eastsiders. They are like halfway Christians. They go to church, they do their service, they, you know, say, yes, I'm a Christian. But they really haven't come all the way into the promised land to walk in the fullness of the victory and the rest that God has promised. That's basically what the Promised Land represents to us. Now I want to read to you this verse here. This is a famous verse that a lot of us studied a long time. But I'm going to read it from the Aramaic, and so I typed it up here for you. It's 2 Corinthians 10:3 to 5. It says, "For although we walk in the flesh, we do not serve of the flesh." King James says war, right? War after the flesh, or war according to the flesh. And here, flesh just means by the senses. By our physical senses, we do not fight the war. "For the equipment of our service is not of the flesh, but of the power of God. And by it," by what? "By the power of God, we overcome rebellious strongholds. And we pull down reasonings and all pride that elevates itself against the knowledge of God. And we lead captive all thoughts to the obedience of Christ." See, the power, the warfare of our service is not carnal, but it is by God's power that anything ever gets accomplished. If you have any victory in your life, it is because of the power of God. By it, see, by the power of God. The power is not ours. It's a spiritual power that we get given, and it yields spiritual victory. Isn't that cool? Now that word warfare, the warfare is the word strategy. So our strategy is not carnal either. It's not of the flesh. It's not by the senses. It is a spiritual warfare. I found this really, really wonderful quote. It's from a place called foundationsforfreedom.net. Sometime if you like to go on there and see, they have some really wonderful articles. But it was talking about the victory, and it says, "Victory only arises when one fully understands temptation and wholly depends on the Lord's means of deliverance." See, it's God's means of deliverance. And in every case and in every situation and in every battle, that's different. That's a different strategy, right? But the common denominator through the whole thing is that it is not of the senses. It's spiritual. So that's the basic introduction to the idea of what the strategy is. Now, when you want to cross over the Jordan into the Promised Land, it means that you have to deal with the ites. And the ites that occupied the eastern side of the land of Canaan, they were all different tribes of the Canaanites. There were seven different nations, and they are really what we were just reading about, the rebellious strongholds. They had come in and taken over the land that belonged and had been promised to Abraham. And so, these seven nations, you have the Perizzites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Hivites. They are the ites, all right? And what we're going to see is that all the battles that Joshua fought were specifically against these ites. And the ites can spiritually just represent specific things that we are all going to have to deal with in order to live in the Promised Land. So I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 15. I hope you brought an ESV or can look on with someone who has an ESV, because I'm going to be reading from it the whole time. If you don't have one, that's fine, because, you know, it's just a little bit easier to understand, and that's why I chose to read it. It's a relatively new translation called the English Standard Version. I think it was published in 2006 or 7, and it really simplifies the verses, especially the Old Testament. So we're going to read in Genesis 15, and this is where God promised Abraham that he was to inherit the land. And in verse 7, it says, "And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess." And then go down to verse 13, because right after that, God just confirms a covenant with Abraham in saying that he is covenanting, that he promises Abraham that he will possess this land. But verse 13 says, "Then the Lord said to Abraham, Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nations that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions." So basically, what it's saying here is that God made the promise to Abraham, right? But it took 400 years for it to come to pass. During the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they wandered up and down through the land of Canaan, and then eventually there was a big famine in the land of Canaan, and they went to Egypt, and then they stayed in Egypt for roughly 200 years, and only part of that was in slavery. So the total amount of the time is 400 years, from the time of the promise to the time that they actually enter into the land. Now, this is the reason why it took so long. Because you think, you know, hey, if God promised something, he should just get right to it. Now, you know, why didn't he just give the land to Abraham? I mean, I think that's a good question, don't you? But it took this much time because of this. And that's why I wanted to read it. Verse 15, "As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." What God is such a God of so much mercy. And even though the iniquity, which is like the worst kind of sin in the Old Testament, is the word iniquity. And that's what these Canaanites or Amorites had done, is they had already had this kind of iniquity. But God literally gave them 400 years to repent. And if at any time during that time they had repented, he would not have destroyed them. But because throughout that entire time, all they did was basically get worse and worse and worse and worse. So by the time you get to the time of Joshua, it was at the point where the iniquity was full or complete. And that's when God said, okay, that's it. Shh, done. We're over. Now, even so, I think there's a lot of people that have questions about, you know, isn't it kind of cruel for God to just tell Joshua to wipe out all the Canaanites? I mean, you know, we come from a culture which is live and let live, right? And it sounds very, very harsh to us that God wanted Joshua to kill off all these people. And, I mean, after all, they were in the land, right? We should just get along. Well, I'll tell you some of the reasons why this iniquity that the Canaanites had. First of all, Canaan is the son of Ham. Noah had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And Ham had incest with his mother. And the result of that was the son, Canaan. So Canaan is born out of incest, first of all. That starts the iniquity. But then the second thing is that the gods and the idols that they incorporated and how they set up their culture was they set up a culture of what's called divine kings, where they set up a god who eventually was called Baal. And Baal is the closest God to the true Jehovah. It's like the counterfeit. It's just so close that it was very difficult for people who did not have the Spirit of God, right, to distinguish. So they were always following after this God who was called Baal. And the kings that ruled over like the local communities all said that they were gods. So it was like divine kings. And so there's a combination of idolatry and pride, which is very, very strong in this culture of the Canaanites. They stole the land that had been given to Shem, and that's the reason why they were in the land of Canaan. That was not supposed to be their land to begin with, but they decided that they liked it. And so they went there and dug in. And the iniquity and the kinds of iniquity that they had was, for example, every firstborn child would be killed and stuck in a jar and put in the wall of the house. They had orgies. The sexual perversion was really strong. It's when you really start reading about what they did in their rituals and in the celebration of their religion and everything, it's like, wow, God had mercy on that. For that long, he had mercy on that. He allowed them to continue, and in the meantime, he took care of his people because of how he had promised Abraham that he would give him this land. So that's pretty cool, huh? All right. Well, now I want to just talk a little bit about Joshua's character, because I hope you got a chance to read the first five chapters of Joshua. We didn't have time to be able to read the whole thing. But Joshua is a really wonderful man of God. And I thought there were basically three points to his character that we could just look at briefly. The first one is that he was willing to be a servant, and he had served Moses faithfully for over 40 years before he became the leader of Israel. 40 years. He was not the leader. He was the servant. That shows something about his dedication and his meekness. Those three characteristics was he was willing to be a servant, he was very meek, he was faithful, and he was really dedicated to God. Because what he did with Moses, like when Moses went up on the mount to get the Ten Commandments, Joshua went up on the mountain with him. He didn't go all the way to the top. He didn't have the direct connection with God himself. But he stayed about halfway down the mountain that entire 40 days when Moses was up on the mountain and prayed for him. When Moses would go into the tabernacle and worship, and the Shekinah glory would come into the tabernacle when Moses was there communing with God, Joshua stayed right outside the door, the east door, into the tabernacle. He stayed right there the whole time Moses was in the tabernacle. And then when Moses would come out, then he would serve him. But wherever Moses went, that's where he went. And he really learned from Moses how to be meek and how to submit to God's will during those 40 years. Joshua was also one of the spies that had gone into the promised land originally, when they first came out of Egypt, right? And he, along with Caleb, had been the ones that says, "Let us go up at once and possess the land, for we are well able to overcome it." You know, he was gung-ho and ready. He was going to go right into the promised land right then. It didn't matter whether there were giants, how many people were occupying it, how evil they were. It did not matter to Joshua. But God said, no. Because everyone else did not want to go in, right? And so it took 40 years of him being faithful, not to lose that enthusiasm. Because, see, if it had been up to him, and really, I think if it had been up to me, like, why can't we have it right now? You know, we need to just go get it right now. And that's not what God had in mind, because he had to wait for all those people who had that unbelief to die off in the wilderness. But Joshua and Caleb are the two spies who were alive, who were over 20 years old at that time, who got to go into the promised land. Moses didn't even get to go into the promised land. Just Joshua and Caleb. So you can see from these kinds of points in Joshua's character that it set the stage for him to be able to be the kind of leader that he is and what we're going to read about. He doesn't rush into things. And he really endeavors to listen to God. So even within that, we're going to see that there were things that he needed to learn about listening to God. Even I want to just look at Joshua 5 for a few minutes. Because what happened was when they crossed over the Jordan, the river Jordan dried up so that they could walk across, right? And that was just a tremendous miracle that you could get all these people to be able to cross the Jordan on dry land. So you'd think that, wow, this great miracle happened. Now let's just go into the promised land. Let's get busy. Let's have some battles. No. The first thing that Joshua does, Joshua chapter 5, verse 4, is that he circumcises the men. It says, and this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. They crossed over the Jordan. Now they're in enemy territory. So what does Joshua do? He circumcises all the people that had been born in the wilderness. And so they're completely vulnerable, right? For at least a week. And they just stay there. They're just very focused. This is what God wants us to do, because it was, let's see, where does it say here? Verse 6. For the people of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. The Lord swore to them that he would not let them see the land that the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So those guys who were murmurers, right, they were the complainers, they died in the wilderness. They never got to see the promised land. But they specifically did not circumcise their children. That really shows the depth of their unbelief. Because they refused to acknowledge the covenant God by circumcising their children. They didn't do it. So that's the first thing that Joshua does. And then verse 9 it says, and the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. And so the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. Because the name Gilgal means rolled away. Rolled away. He rolled away the reproach so that they could come into covenant relationship with God again. And in that covenant relationship with God, God promised that he would take care of them in every single aspect. So that's how come they're going to get to have these victories. The second thing that he did, let's see, it goes on in verse 10 there. While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. Now, Jericho is this stronghold. It's got this huge wall, and they could see it from Gilgal, where they were camped. Here's the enemy. He's got this giant city up on this hill, and you could see it from their camp. So what else did they do? They said, okay, we're going to celebrate the Passover. And in the Passover then, they were confessing their sins. They were acknowledging that God was their provider, that he had passed over, the angel of death had passed over them in Egypt, right? Okay, well, then it's like confirming, well, if it did it once, he can do it again, right? The angel of death can pass over now, too. We do not have to be afraid of whatever strongholds or whatever enemy, and it doesn't matter if we're sitting in enemy territory. God will take care of us. So, you know, you sometimes it's easy to look at Joshua and just say, oh, he was so great. He was such a wonderful man, you know, and kind of put him up on a pedestal, right? And think, I could never be like that. I mean, he's leading a million people into the promised land, you know. He's getting victory after victory after victory, as we'll see. So, but the thing is, see, everyone today is a Joshua. We can all be Joshuas. Because all that Joshua, even his name, means is Jehovah saves. And God, Jehovah, has saved us, right? And he has given us the victory. And he already has laid out the promised land of milk and honey spiritually for us. So every one of us is a Joshua. So please don't read these records thinking, oh, that's just the Old Testament. Or that's just somebody who is really great and I could never be like that. We absolutely can be like that. Now, the other thing that Joshua did at the end of chapter 5 there, just briefly go over, is in verse 13, it says, when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. Uh-oh, we got enemies. We're in enemy territory. And Joshua goes out by himself towards Jericho. And all of a sudden, this guy comes back with this giant sword in his hand. And he says, are you for us or for our adversaries? And the man said, or whoever it was, said, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. King James says, I am the captain of the Lord's host. Whoa! You think that gave some encouragement to Joshua? Here, this mighty angel, I believe it was an angel, one of the captains of the Lord's host, means all of God's mighty army of angels, came specifically to go to tell Joshua something. And this is what Joshua asks. He says, and Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to my servant? What is it you have to tell me? I'm listening. I'm willing. I'm ready to do whatever it is that you tell me to do. And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place that you are standing on is holy. And Joshua did so. That must have been just such an incredible encouragement to him. Basically, what the angel was saying to Joshua was, you are not going to have to fight this. You may be the captain of your army, but the true captain is the one who is going to be fighting all the battles. And all you have to do is follow. So it was an incredible comfort to him. And I love the part, too, also, about how Joshua asks the question, What shall I do? What shall I do? So before we start talking about the Battle of Jericho, I think we have a special presentation here by Josh and Bob, who are going to come up and play you a song.
Are you familiar with that song? Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho. It goes back, the background of that song goes all the way back to the early 1800s. And African-American slaves at that time, they were getting, a lot of them were getting born again of God's Spirit. And they would learn God's Word. And they would sing, and they would fit some of these great stories in the Old Testament to songs. And they came up with this, Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, or some of the titles are Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho. But you don't know, I always wondered how Joshua got here, you know, because his parents were none. He was the son of none. Let's try this song out here. We're going to go through the words here a little bit, so we're going to go a little slow first time around, and I want you all to join in as we do this a couple times. All right, here we go.
You're going to kind of sing it through a little bit. We'll sing it through a little bit.
Yeah, we'll kind of get you started. You'll pick up the words.
Yeah. Josh is like my, remember Moses at Aaron? Josh is like my Aaron. He's playing today. And it's really awesome because he just picked up the ukulele for the first time this morning, just before we got started. So
he's got it.
You're playing it.
So.
All right.
Here we go.
Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and the walls come tumbling down. You may talk about the King Gideon. You may talk about your man Saul. You just about Joshua at the Battle of Jericho. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and the walls come tumbling down. All right, let's do it again. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and the walls come tumbling down. You may talk about your King of Gideon. Talk about your man Saul. There's none like good old Joshua at the Battle of Jericho. Oh, Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and the walls come tumbling down.
Oh, that's great. I love that song. The funniest part about that song is that Joshua did fight the Battle of Jericho, but actually it was the Lord who fought the Battle of Jericho and made the walls come tumbling down. That's what we're going to see. So let's look at Joshua chapter 6, starting in verse 1 here. It says, "Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua," so this may either be the same mighty angel or just the Lord directly saying to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and the mighty men of valor." It was a promise. God gave him a very, very specific promise. "I have given Jericho into your hand." And if you look on your outline there, the "ite" that we're dealing with in Jericho is pride and idolatry. Because Jericho was the center of the god I was telling you about, Baal, right? His previous name before his name was Baal was Yerek, where you get the name Jericho from. And Yerek means moon. And he was like a moon god. And they had all of this ritual that they did. Remember I was telling you about the rituals, right? The ritual that they did in Jericho as the center of this worship of the idol was to inaugurate this divine king who was the king of Jericho and to go through this whole sexual ritual about how, you know, he was the ultimate god who was the provider of everything and everything and everything. And at the spring season, which is exactly the time when this is going on, was the celebration of their festival of this moon god. And so when God gives the directions to Joshua of what to do, it doesn't really make sense logically. Let's read it, verse 3. He tells Joshua, he says, "You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horn before the ark. On the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times. And the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And the people shall go up, every one straight before him." Now, don't you think that sounds really silly? Oh, my goodness. It was definitely unusual thing to do, because the first thing they had to do was they had to have a specific parade, basically. You had the men of war coming in first. Then you had the priests with the trumpets. Then you had the ark. And then you had more of the army in the back. And they would circle around the city. Now, let's just see. The first time that they did that, the people were looking over the wall, right? Uh-oh, they're coming. They're going to attack. We're ready. We're ready. And it's completely silent except for the blowing of the ram's horn. You know, constantly for an hour. That's how long it took to walk around the city, was an hour. There must have been incredible anticipation in the enemy of like, okay, now what? And they go back to camp. And they do that for 6 days. And then the 7th day, they don't go back to camp after the first time. Then after the second time, they don't go back to camp. They don't go back after the 3rd time. Nor after the 4th. By that time, you know, I think that people would be getting kind of tired, because by the 4th time, they've already been walking for 4 hours straight. I mean, I walked around Amsterdam for half the day and was like, "Ah, where is the chair?" They had to walk around 7 times. And the promise was there, right? That once they got to the end of the 7th time and Joshua gave the signal for them to shout, that's when the walls would fall down, right? What if they'd have just stopped at number 6? They wouldn't have got the victory, right? So that's one of the first keys that we get to see, and the strategy is you have to obey all of the steps. You have to follow the whole direction. If you stop somewhere halfway in it and go, oh, that didn't work, then you don't get to see the walls fall down. Now, part of that moon god ritual had to do with silently going up to this palace citadel for 8 days. So 7 days. So what they were doing and what God was doing by having the children of Israel march around the city, it was really making a mockery out of the moon god. Just like he did in Egypt with the plagues. Every one of those plagues was directed towards some specific god that the people trusted in. And because of that, that's part of the reason why they had to do this, quote, silly thing. Now, they didn't know that, right? So it's a very similar kind of thing in that the second key that I see is that we have to be quiet and just say, okay, yes, God, I will do whatever you say, even if it doesn't make sense to me, because I know that you have a bigger view. I'm going to shut my mouth. Yes, Lord, I will do it, right? And that's when also we get the victory. There's a couple other really neat keys in there. Was they had to work together in order to organize this whole parade, right? And they had to be silent as they were walking around. They had to help each other obey. And that's the same, too, in today. You know, when we are facing something as large as a Jericho in our lives, a citadel of pride or a stronghold, one of those rebellious strongholds, right? We need each other. We need each other to do it together and to encourage one another and to say, yeah, go obey. Do what God told you to do. Just go for it. Do it. Follow it through. It'll work. I promise. And so I think that to see that it was a mockery towards this moon god, and also that they had to work together. Now, right before they were walking 7 times around, right? 1, 2. It's going to take about 8 hours to get this done here. 3. Man, I'm getting really tired. Can you imagine those priests, how tired they were of blowing that ram's horn for 8 hours straight? Woo! No talking, nothing, right? They get to the end of the 7th time, and then Joshua says, shout. And guess what? The walls fall down! Oh, my goodness. I found this really, really, really neat quote about one of the things about them being silent. It says, great victories are often lost through the uncontrolled use of our tongue. In every battle of life, to win great victories, overcome strong enemies, overthrow and conquer formidable strongholds, we must be obedient to divine instructions and also learn when to be silent, when to speak, and when to shout. Isn't that cool? Yeah, we have to know when to do the shouting. And you just don't give up. That's one of the biggest lessons of Jericho. Don't give up. Go through all the steps. But when you get to the end of the step, then shout. Because that's the time that the wall will fall down. And it's really always hardest before you get the victory. Like that 7 times around, that was a hard day. They thought 1 hour was hard. 7 times around was hard. That was hard. And it didn't seem like it was doing anything, right? So that's the other lesson, or the strategy, is just go through the whole thing. And even if it looks like it's getting completely hard, then don't give up. look at verse 16 of Joshua 6. At the seventh time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent." Rahab was the only one who was delivered out of Jericho. Every other person in the city of Jericho died. But Rahab was saved because she believed God, right? And that's the whole story of the red thread of the scarlet cord. If you remember a long time ago when we did that, I think it's on the website on my website, you can still go hear the first teaching about the scarlet cord is called A Life for a Life. Rahab promised her life for the life of her family and the life of her family if she would not give away the spies that had come in there. So God saved her. But now this is what God told God told Joshua and the children of Israel that they had to do. Verse 18. It says, "But you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction." They devoted the whole city of Jericho. It's called, in the ESV, it's called devoted to destruction. And, or devoted. And what that means is that it was to be dedicated to God. All of the victory of Jericho was to be dedicated to God. And it says on there, verse 18, "Lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all the silver and gold and every vessel of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So what God had said was, Jericho is going to be mine because it's the first victory. And all of the spoil, all the silver, the gold, everything that was of value like that was going to go into the treasury, into the temple of God. So they were not to take anything from Jericho. All right, that's very important to remember. So verse 20. "So the people shouted and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout and the wall fell down flat so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city." They captured it. They got to go straight in. Now, you know, the archaeologists and all sorts of scientists have been arguing for years and years and years. Well, we don't see any evidence of how Jericho's wall fell down flat, you know. And they basically, you know, have tried very, very hard to dispute the fact that there was a wall that fell down at this particular century, even. They can't find it. But what I believe the answer is that later on you're going to see that there was such a total destruction of Jericho that it was never rebuilt. The Jericho, which is the actual city in Israel today, there's a city, Jericho. It's in a slightly different location. It's a little bit farther away. And so the tell, or the archaeological dig, they just are not looking in the right place. And also, it's very, very interesting too, because the lady who was the primary archaeologist in this site, she was an unbeliever and she wanted to discredit the Bible. And so whatever evidence there was when they dug down into that layer, they filled it in and somehow discredited it, because she didn't want it to prove that there really was a wall, where the rubble was there, completely there. And but I believe eventually someone, you know, if the Lord tarries, will find that wall and see it, because if God said it happened, then it truly did happen. And it doesn't really matter if they ever do find it or not, but it would be kind of neat if they did. That would show that there really was a great victory that day. So just to summarize there about the first two strategies we have here, you see in the character of Joshua that he was willing to be a servant and he was meek to listen to what God told him to do. And he was dedicated to God. But when he came up against Jericho, he didn't just rush in and say, okay, I'm fighting the battle. No, he said, okay, God, what do I do? And when God told him to do something that was really completely illogical, he did it anyway. And he followed every step down to the letter of it. And he led the people in that march around the city. They worked together. They stayed silent and submissive to God and closed their mouths. But when it was the time, then they shouted all together and the walls fell down. So we could take a 15-minute break and have some coffee. And when we come back, we're going to look at the battle of Ai. Bless you.